This morning's message is called The Lost Truth of Our Civilization, and it's a message I've been thinking about for a while. It's not something that I was kind of thinking, you know, what am I going to preach on today, even though we're following Independence Day. Yesterday, July 4th, was Independence Day. And sometimes, not always, I've preached a message kind of related to that theme, but this message is all about that theme. But it's not something I just started thinking about because it was Independence Day. It's something I've been thinking about for a while. And I'm going to try as hard as I can to breeze through this. By breeze, I mean move as quickly as I can through it. And I apologize ahead of time because there's a lot been going around in my brain that I've been trying to put all into a PowerPoint slide, and that's not easy to do. And one of the reasons why I'm saying this is because I think there are moments, there are times in history that we devote a lot of attention to. There's a lot of books, volumes of books, written about specific times of history because there's just moments within history, within lives, within our lives that we just go back to constantly or that we highlight because it was something that changed history. So, you know, obviously 9/11 was one of those moments in history. There's lots written about it. There's lots people made songs about that certain time. There's just, we focus a lot on 9/11. I don't know if you knew what you were doing this past Independence Day in, you know, maybe 1993. 1998, 2006. There's just moments within history in which we focus on because those moments seem to impact and have a ripple effect throughout all of history. And this is just my own opinion. It seems like 2020 is one of those moments within history. Not only because of the global pandemic, our world in a matter of 3 months looks different than it looked for, you know, 30, 40, 50 plus years, maybe more than that. Within 3 months, things have changed dramatically. And now we here in the United States of America look out at our own country and we see things changing dramatically. A lot of things are changing. And it seems like 2020 might be one of those moments in history that 100 years from now, should man still be alive, in the year 2525. That's a song, I think, isn't it? Okay. Next week, you guys, we need that song. In 100 years from now, I think there'll be a lot more books about 2020 than about 2019 or 2018. I think this moment in our history is going to have a resounding impact. We're already saying that. We're already wondering, how is this going to change my job? There's lots of people working from home. And there's lots of people like, you know what, I might never go back to the office anymore. I've said in multiple occasions, if you've ever watched the show The Office, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, people are going to be like, what? People went into a building from 8 to 4 or 9 to 5 all day long, and they had birthday parties there and Christmas parties, and it's going to be weird. It's like, what were those people doing? It might happen. I don't know. That's what people are asking. 2020 just seems like one of those moments, and there's other things happening within our own culture that seems to be trying to dramatically shift the way that we viewed the world for a long time, the way that we made sense of the world, the way that we lived as Americans for a long time. So I'm using this word civilization. You know, there's lots of civilizations that have lived throughout history. And back when we studied history in school, you learned about some of those civilizations, and then you learned what was good about those civilizations and maybe what was bad about those civilizations. And then the next preceding civilization tried not to make the same mistakes, maybe, or maybe they did make the same mistakes. But when you studied that civilization, you were basically studying a group of people that viewed the world a particular way, and then they lived in light of that view of the world. Now we call that a worldview. It's kind of like the way you put on glasses and you view the world through certain lenses. So I view the world through a Christian worldview. I make decisions, choices. I make sense of what I see through a Christian worldview. The acceptance of a God who is a creator and designer, who believe, my Christian worldview says I believe the scriptures are true. I believe Jesus did come. I believe he was God in flesh and that he died and he rose again. And I believe all these certain things about life in the world because I view the world through a Christian lens. And so for a long time, our civilization used what they call Judeo-Christian values. And we say Judeo because a lot of the conclusions we've arrived at come out of the Hebrew scriptures and through Christian principles. Like the golden rule, you know, when you learned that in school at one time, do unto your neighbor as you would do unto yourself. That was something that you just learned. That comes straight out of the scriptures. And so everybody in school taught that because we as a group of people believed that was a good value. And so we decided as an entire group, we're going to value that kind of thing. So this morning when I say like we, I don't just mean us in this room. I mean we as a civilization, as the American civilization, talking about our cultural moment right now. And I'm going to define that word for you. But I'm going to use something out of 2 Kings as a metaphor. It's not literally what is going on today. And we can't change Israel for the United States of America. We can't change King Josiah for Donald Trump. I'm not interchanging these people. I'm simply using a story that maybe can inform our current situation. It's symbolic of something I think is going on right now within our civilization. And when I say that word, I'm speaking specifically about the American experience, about this American experiment that started 244 years ago. And so we need to start with a particular question. I want you to think about, you at home can think about this question as well. And you can read up there on the screen. How do you make sense of the world? So when you make a decision, when you make choices, when you turn the TV on, when you read history, when you see current events, when stuff happens in life, how do you make sense of that? We are all trying to do that because our making sense of life and the world informs how we choose to live. So each of us does that ourselves. You do that personally. You personally try and make sense of the world for how you decide to live. Every day you're doing that. Whether you think about it a lot or you think about it a little, you're trying to make sense of this world so that you can navigate it and hopefully navigate it well. And what we advocate in the Christian worldview is to flourish as a human being. God designed us to flourish. And so how can we best do that as a human? And we talked about, well, we best do that in relationship. It's how we're designed to be. And so we say it's important to be in relationship. So the way I make sense of the world is through the fact that I'm designed to be in relationship. I think that's an important part of my life. And so I do that. I personally do that. Now, we do that as a family. And you had to do that too. Your parents did that for you. If you're raising kids now, you're doing that for your kids. You are helping them make sense of the world. Mommy, daddy, why does this happen? Why does that happen? Why did that just do that? Why is this going on? And you're trying to explain it so they can make sense of it. Because at six, you know, they're only going to make sense of it so much. And when they're 16, it's going to be a little bit different. When they're 26, it's different. And then when they're 36, it's different. I mean, it goes down the line. We're trying to help them make sense of the world now so that when they get older, they can navigate this thing we call life and make sense of it themselves. Your parents did that for you, and you did it for your kids, whether you realized it or not. The way that my parents made sense of the world has impacted and influenced the way that I do. And so I decided, and I felt called to ministry, and I said, this makes so much sense, the Christian experience and the way that God describes the world, that I'm going to devote my life to telling all of you about it and helping other people come to know this Jesus so that they can change their lives too. That is me making sense of the world around me. I think the world makes sense better and we can navigate life better with Jesus in our lives. And because that makes so much sense to me, I said, I'm going to do that the rest of my life. Now, that's something that I did, and that's something that my family is choosing to do. And so my kids are going to make sense of the world in light of the scriptures, in light of what God has done, in light of the fact that Jesus has come. Now, we do that in even larger scales as a community, us together. You're here because in some way, shape, or form, you think whatever is being preached out of here, I do this every single Sunday. I take this book, we call it the Bible, and I preach out of it. And we think in some way, shape, or form, that helps us make sense of our world and my current experience. I mean, that's the whole point. The application part is saying, okay, that's great that the Bible says that, but what does that mean in my life now? And my job, sometimes I do it better than others, is to help us figure that out. I'm trying to figure that out, and I'm going to ask you to come along on that journey in figuring that out. And we, as a group, as a community, are trying to make sense of the world together, and we're going to hold a certain set of ideals. We just sang about them. We believe in God the Father Almighty, His Son Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit. We are making sense of the world, including that category, into our decision-making, our choices, the way we raise our families, the way that I interact with people, how I behave at my job, whether or not I cheat on my taxes or this test. All of that influences and impacts the way we live. Okay, so now what if we're going to not just take a collection of 100 people, 150 people, some of the bigger churches, 1,000 people, some churches overseas, 10,000 people. What if we're going to take 1 million people, 2 million, 3 million, 400, 100 million people? What if we're going to create an entire society? How is an entire group of people, a society, as big and as vast as the United States of America, going to make sense of the world? How do we do that? This is the word I want us to use in terms of culture. This is how we make sense of the world. Shared belief in values that drive the behavior of a group of people. So we're a group of people. Let's just call our civilization a group of people. And so the way that our group of people made sense of the world was how we are going to share certain beliefs and certain values. And we're going to say, you know what, let's agree to these certain things so that we can help make sense of this world so that we can flourish as human beings. And we're not going to just do that as Ted or Jess. We both do that, or our family, or just our community. We need to try and do that for an entire society. A shared belief in value system that drives the behavior of an entire group of people. This happens all over the world. It happens all throughout history. Every civilization decided this. Some civilizations were decided by one person, and that person said, we're all going to live this way. Oh, you don't like to live that way? See you later. Never heard from them again. We call those people dictators and tyrants. Some people and some civilizations say, we're just going to do whatever we want, and we're not going to listen to anybody. And we call that anarchy and chaos. You know how long it took to build the Roman civilization? 1,000 years. This thing we call Roman civilization that we still have things from. There are still Roman roads. If you go to foreign countries, roads that were built by the Romans. 1,000+ years to build that civilization. Within about 200 years, it was gone. Broken apart, dismantled. It doesn't take long to change things. But this group of people said, we're going to have this value system, these beliefs, and that is going to shape how we do life. And we're all going to agree to it, and we're going to live that way. And that's kind of what happened on July 4th, 1776. This group of people, we call them representatives, representing another group of people, said, look, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to live. And so maybe it'd be good for us to look at other civilizations and people who came before us and said, well, how did they make sense of the world? How did they decide to live? How did they organize their life, their families, the things they did, the choices they made? How did they do that? We call that history. When we look at somebody else's lived experience and we see their life, we're trying to learn something from them, because we are really a blip on the timeline of history. The United States of America is a blip. Your life and my life is a blip on the timeline of history. So it seems wise to look at all the other people that have already lived this thing we call life and see how they did it. How did they make sense of the world? And maybe some of the things they learned would help us to flourish as humans. So yesterday we had our, and some of you probably did this, July 4th Independence picnic. It was a little smaller this year. My family does different things on July 4th. There was a smaller group, but it was my parents and my family and Jess's mom and her grandmother. Her grandmother has seen, now she doesn't remember some of these, but she has seen 103 Independence Days. Her grandmother's 103 years old, and I said when she left, this is your 103rd Independence Day. That's a pretty big feat. But one of the things, and I've said this before, one of the things that she says is life seems so short. Imagine that 103 Independence Days that she saw, and it's just a little blip. So maybe we ought to learn how the people that have already lived this thing we call life made sense of life. And that's something that people did. At one time, they learned from the past. As broken, as flawed, as messed up as the past is, you can still learn from it. And so that's what we're going to do. This message is kind of, as I said, something that's been rattling around in my brain for a while. Because I'm looking at our civilization, and I'm really, really concerned about it. And I think there's some lost truths about our civilization that we have forgotten about, that unless we regain these lost truths, we're going to be in trouble. And it's lost truths that other people long before us discovered, realized, and put into a system that has lasted for 244 years and really has changed the course of history and has shaped the world that we live in right now. You and I are beneficiaries of things that we had no control over. People who gave it to us and said, here, we've kept it this long, now it's your turn to take the baton and keep going with it. And so we're going to kind of use a story out of Israel's history as a metaphor for our own story. There was a quote or a story about C.S. Lewis, who is a pretty famous Christian theologian and thinker and apologist. Wasn't always a Christian, had been an atheist before that. And when C.S. Lewis was kind of working through his own making sense of the world, whether or not to include God in that, you know, as an atheist, God is not a part of it at all. And he's kind of working through this and saying, maybe the world makes more sense with God in it. He's walking along with J.R.R. Tolkien. If you've ever watched or read Lord of the Rings series, those were written by Tolkien. He was an author. And they're walking along, and I'm paraphrasing here. And C.S. Lewis is basically saying, and you have to imagine a British accent. I can't do a British accent. And he's saying, you know, Christianity is just another story people tell themselves to make sense of the world. Lots of civilizations have told each other stories and have told each other religious stories to try and make sense of the world. And Tolkien says to him, well, what if this story is the one true story? And the other stories are reflections of this one true story. And as a follower of Jesus, that's basically what I'm telling the world around me. I think this story being told is a reflection of this one true story, of what, how life makes the most sense, includes God. And Israel's history is trying to tell us a story about our own moment. I mean, that's why the scriptures are so powerful. Because their story can tell us something about our story. And I think it does. And I think it's symbolic of what's going on now. And unless we regain these truths of our civilization, of what people before us believed, and tried to create a belief in a value system that would drive an entire nation, unless we regain some of that, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. So to begin, you need a brief history. A brief history of Israel. This is something Winston Churchill said. A nation that forgets its past has no future. Civilization in Winston Churchill's day was hanging by a thread. There were people that made sense of the world that said, we are the master race, and our Third Reich will reign for 1,000 years, and you can either get on board or we're going to roll right over you. And in Winston Churchill's day, he said, those who forget the past have no future. Civilization as they knew it was hanging by a thread. And so that's why we call it a world war. The world was at war to see what it was going to look like on the other end. History tells us, communicates to us, what our story might look like as well. And Israel is doing that same thing. In 1 and 2 Kings, it was actually one book of the Bible. It was one story about Israel's history. They put it on two scrolls, and so that's why you have 1 Kings and 2 Kings. It sits on two scrolls. But it's a story about Israel's history. And you need a little bit of that story to understand Josiah's story and how Josiah and his story might speak something into ours, into our current state of affairs. When you look out at the American experience and you think to yourself, what the heck is going on? Maybe this can tell us something. So in Israel, you had a king, King David. 1 and 2 Samuel is a story about these 12 tribes that came together under one king. It started with Saul, but the kingdom was not united under Saul. And if you know that whole story, God said Saul was kind of doing his own thing and said, I don't really care about you, God. We're going to do what I want to do. And God anoints David. And 1 and 2 Samuel is kind of that story of David becoming king, ultimately uniting these 12 tribes into one people called Israel in the United Kingdom. 1 Kings starts with this United Kingdom. David is king. He's dying. He's passing on the throne to his son, Solomon. They are living under this unified, the tribes being unified, and there's one single monarchy. That is King David. And 1 and 2 Kings talks about that being passed to King Solomon. King Solomon rules for a little while in 1 Kings. And if you remember something important about Solomon, he's the guy that built the temple that said, hey, we're going to build this temple where God will dwell. Heaven and earth will meet in the temple. And that's God's dwelling place. And I'm going to build it, Solomon said. And so he sets out in doing that. One of the other things famous about Solomon is he asked God for wisdom. If there's anything you could have in this entire world, what do you want? Solomon says, I want wisdom. And believed to be the wisest man to ever walk the earth, except for Jesus, of course. Except by the end of Solomon's reign, with all the wisdom that he had, by the end of his reign, the author of Kings says that he looked more like Pharaoh, you know, the guy that enslaved the Jews. By the end of Solomon's reign, he had slaves building his temples and buildings. And the author of Kings says he looked more like Pharaoh than he did his father David. Because the author of Kings is trying to communicate a message to the people reading this story. He's not just writing it down for, hey, guess what? Oh, this is cool. This is happening. Let's just write this stuff down. The author is writing this history so that Israel could learn something from it. And he based good kings off of bad kings on three different criteria on whether or not they followed God. They kept the covenant and they didn't worship other idols. And the author just based his, was he a good king or a bad king? He based all that off of that three criteria. The majority of those kings were bad kings. Solomon, by the end of his reign, was one of those guys. By the end of the reign of Solomon, the kingdoms have split apart. There is now the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. All that God was doing to take these 12 tribes, their family, they're the 12 tribes of Israel, they are family, and unite them as one people. By the end of Solomon's reign, they are separated. The northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. and there is nothing but chaos taking place in Israel. First and Second Kings follows that story. 22 kings in the northern kingdom, 12 kings in the southern kingdom, or 8 were good out of 12-ish kings in the southern kingdom, and he follows them all, and no king in the northern kingdom was a good king. They all walked away from what God had set up with Abraham, Jacob, and Moses, and only a handful did what was right in the Lord's eyes in the southern kingdom. So we're getting now closer to this story of Josiah. The kingdoms are separated. Things are falling apart. It is not good. People are turning on the television and they're like, what in the world is going on? They didn't have TV. Just seeing if you know history or not. TV wasn't around then. They're looking at their world. They can't make sense of it. It is whoever has the most power rules. This king kills that king. That king kills that king. It is nothing but chaos. There is nothing like human flourishing taking place. And we fast forward into 2 Kings chapter 21. And we have this guy named Manasseh. Manasseh ruled over the southern kingdom. And they basically had to come up with a new definition for wickedness for this guy. He was so wicked, the definition that they had for wickedness didn't fit. So they had to come up with a new one because of how horrible this guy was. It's believed because of archaeological finds, it's believed that he possibly even instituted child sacrifice into the worship. He built gods inside the temple, you know, the place where God dwelled, the place where heaven and earth met. He built gods inside of there. All the other pagan gods, he erected statues to all them. And he basically, if God said go this way, he was going as fast as he could the other way. So for 55 years, that's what they've experienced, is what his reign is believed to have had. He is dead, he dies, killed, and his son takes over, Ammon. That's in 2 Kings chapter 21, verse 19. He only lasts about 2 years before he's killed. There's a coup. They kill him. And now King Josiah comes. This is the mess this 8-year-old boy becomes king as a part of. 1 Kings chapter 22, we find the story of Josiah. And I'm just going to read a little bit of it for you. So all that synopsis, all that history is in 1 and 2 Kings, is in 1 and 2 Chronicles. And you can read all about it. And the author of that book is trying to tell us something about our own experience, or at least the readers of his day, and I would contend the readers of our day of the scriptures are trying to tell us something about history. He's speaking specifically to Israel and their history, but I think it's a metaphor for us. This is the world that this 8-year-old boy becomes king in. It's a mess. If you thought our world was bad, it's a mess here. But he discovers something that changes the course of Israel's history for a time. Doesn't change it forever, but it changes Israel's history for a time. Josiah was 8 years old, verse 1 of chapter 22 in 2 Kings. Remember, this is still a BYOB church. Bring your own Bible. Bring your own Bible to church. They're not in the pews. You got to bring your own if you're going to follow along. I encourage you to do that. Chapter 2, 1 Kings. Josiah was 8 years old, this little boy who becomes king. And he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. His mother's name was Jedidah, daughter of Adiah. She was from Bozkath. Ooh, that was loud. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and followed completely the ways of his father David, not turning aside to the right or to the left. So the author kind of gives us a little hint that this is going to be a good story. This is a story you want to repeat. This is the kind of king you want to be like, all you other kings of Israel. This is going to be something good. He tells us that because he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and followed him all the days of his life, and didn't turn to the right or to the left. And so here's the story. How is it he was a good king? In the midst of all this, and the usual refrain is, you know, this guy did what was just followed the ways of his father, and they kept turning away from God and did what was wicked. This guy did follow the ways of his father and did what was wicked. This guy followed the ways of his father and did what was wicked. But Josiah followed the ways of the Lord and did what was right in God's eyes. Well, what happened? What changed his story? In verse 3, in the 18th year of his reign, King Josiah sent the secretary Shaphan, son of Azaliah, the son of Meshullam. Can anybody have like regular names in this thing? To the temple of the Lord. He said, go to Hilkiah, the high priest, and have him get ready the money that has been brought into the temple of the Lord, which the doorkeepers have collected from the people. Have them entrust it to the men appointed to supervise the work in the temple. And have them pay these men, the workers who repair the temple of the Lord, the carpenters and the builders and the masons, and also have them purchase timber and dress stone and repair the temple. But they need not account for the money entrusted to them because they are honest in their dealings. So one of the indicators that tells us Josiah was a good king is he looked at the temple, the place where God dwelt, and he wasn't happy with the way it looked. There were other gods in it. He had erected other temples. They had left it to, or had erected other statues. They left it in a state of disrepair. So Josiah, being a good king, says that is not good enough for God's dwelling place. We're going to do a renovation project. And I'm going to get these contractors, you know, the stonemasons and the carpenters and the builders, and I'm going to get all those contractors, and they must not have been, you know, the contractors that are taking you across, not ripping you off, because he trusted them and said, just give them the money, and they're going to rehab the temple. That's what's going on here. That was a good indication that this king was going to be a good king, because he saw this dwelling place of God where God's presence was, and he was going to rebuild the temple. So he's got his contractors. He sends them to the temple. There's the high priest that's kind of in charge of the whole thing. He's managing. He's the project manager, and they're all coming in, and now they're going to start the rehab of the temple. And that's where we're at in verse 8. The rehab begins, renovation project happens, everybody got their hard hat on, and they're starting to rebuild. Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the secretary, this was like the king's secondhand man, Shaphan the secretary. He says to him, I have found the book of the law in the temple of the Lord. And he gave it to Shaphan, who read it. So Shaphan takes this. He's like, okay, what's the book of the law? He opens it up, and he starts reading it. It must have impacted him so much that he decides to take it back to the king. So then Shaphan, the secretary, went to the king and reported to him, your officials have paid out the money that was in the temple, and the Lord that has entrusted the workers and the supervisor of the temple. Okay, we got the contractors ready. They're going. Renovations are taking place. They're building it, but something happened when we were doing the renovations. Then Shaphan the secretary informed the king, Hilkiah the priest has given me a book. And Shaphan read it in the presence of the king. So he opens this book. He gave me this thing. We found it in the temple. They dusted it off, kind of got the dust off of it, and they started reading it. When his secretary started reading it to the king, this was the king's response. When the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his robes. From that moment on, everything in Israel's history changes. He goes back, he says, go to a prophet and ask the prophet, what in the world does this mean? What is going on? And the prophet tells him what God has said, that God was judging Israel because of the ways in which they have basically spit in his face and turned their back on him, and that what you have found is what God had used to help you become a nation. You've discovered the lost truths of Israel. They found the book of the law. If you read 1 and 2 Samuel, if you read 1 and 2 Kings, if you read 1 and 2 Chronicles, the history of Israel, it is an absolute mess. And we get this little gem in 2 Kings chapter 22 of where Josiah finds the book of the law. And from that moment, everything changes. He tears his robes and weeps aloud. They wept aloud because of how far they had gone from God's intention for their nation. Israel's history was riddled with failure and wickedness and depravity. And they found this book that told them something true about who they are as a people, this book of the law. He comes back and he says, I found this book. And he just opens it and starts reading it. And the response of the king is to tear his robes. And he tells his secretary and all of his attendants to go to the prophet and find out what's going on. And the prophet tells him what God's going to do. But the prophet tells him, she says to him, but God's going to spare you, Josiah, because you understand the truth about who you are and who these people are. And so chapter 23 of Israel's history begins in verse 1, ends in verse 30. It's all about what Josiah does when he institutes all these reforms. For the first time since Joshua chapter 5, they observe the Passover. Remember I said when we were going through John, if you were going to go to three different festivals in Israel, the number one, like if you couldn't make any of the festivals, I don't feel like going. If you couldn't make any of them, you made one, and that was Passover. I mean, it's when God saved them out of Egypt. These people have not observed this ritual, this ceremony, this rite since Joshua chapter 5. They had forgotten who they were and what God had done in their lives. He opens up the book of the law, and he is completely broken. He institutes all these reforms. He gathers all the people, and he opens up the book, and he says, you sit here, and you read this, and nobody's leaving until we're done. And he read the whole book, and they renewed their covenant with God. They pledged themselves to this covenant, it says in verse 3 of 2 Kings chapter 23. The rehab project uncovered something that was lost in their civilization. Most scholars believe it was the Pentateuch. That's the first five books of the Bible. That's what is called the Torah, the laws of Moses. It's what the Jews had defined their entire identity off of, those first five books of the Bible. It's where God makes them a people and a nation. And he gives them the book of Deuteronomy. If it's not the first five books of the Bible, scholars believe it's at least the book of Deuteronomy. And if you read the book of Deuteronomy, it's the book that Moses writes right before they enter the promised land. And it says, this is what's going to make you a nation. This is what's going to make you who you are. Remember this. And the greatest commandment in all of Scripture, at least that's what Jesus said, the greatest commandment in all of Scripture is found in Deuteronomy chapter 6, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That is the book they discovered. When Josiah the king discovered this lost truth of their civilization, why are we killing each other? Why are we doing what we're doing? Everything changed because they discovered that truth. They basically discovered the Hebrew scriptures and what made them them. Their value system, their belief as a people, and how they made sense of the world. And how they fit into this great big world. That is what they discovered. That is what they had lost. And that changed everything for them. Now, as I said, this story doesn't just fit literally into our current culture. We are far removed from the culture of the ancient Near Eastern world, from the language, from the people, from everything they experienced. But I think there are some truths about civilization that transcend time and space, culture, and people. And I think it's those truths of civilization that our founders discovered and enabled you and I to experience what we experience for these last 244 years. The reality is, what you experience in this country is not experienced all over this world. If you read any history, you know that. And I traveled to those worlds. And it's not the same. And I can tell you this, I am glad when my feet land back on this soil. It's just different. Doesn't make us better than other people. but I experience life in a way that I think others should experience life. Human flourishing is possible here because of certain truths about civilization that is not possible in other countries to this day. It's possible here because there are truths about civilization that those who founded our country believed. And it's this one statement that really has changed the course of history in a lot of ways. Changed the course of our history in a lot of ways. And it's a statement that lots of other people in other countries quote all the time when they think about what it means to be free, what it means to flourish as humans. I hope this statement is familiar to you. You can read it up there for yourselves. I hope you know where this comes from. Just so at least I know one of you knows, and if you're at home, you can yell it, and I'll try and hear it through the screen. Does anybody know where you can find this statement? Don't be scared. Where does this statement exist within our founding documents? The Declaration of Independence. Yes, thank you. You were all thinking like, should I say it? I'm not sure. Is that it? I don't know. We hold these truths to be self-evident. I don't need to explain it to you. It is clear within the world that we live, the way we made sense of the world, these truths are self-evident. I don't need a government to tell me that. I don't need a king to tell me that. I don't need a tribal leader to tell me this. It is self-evident that all men, all people are created equal. That simply because you are a human being, you have worth and you have value. That message is clearest and loudest within a Christian worldview. If you go to a culture like India where they have Hinduism and they have a caste system, they have a group of people they call the untouchables. Simply because of who you are cast away from society. And all of you probably have heard of Mother Teresa, who was a Christian, goes to Calcutta and says to all of them, you were created equal in the eyes of God. The loudest and truest expression of that statement comes out of Christianity. It doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter what language you speak. You are made in the image of God. And because of that, even when you are feeble and old and society says you have no utilitarian value, we say you are valuable because you're a human being. Even when you're not even born yet and you're living in a womb, we say you have value because you're a human being. That is what that phrase is saying. That message is preached the loudest within Christianity. Because we are endowed by our Creator. It wasn't given to you by a government, by a king, by a queen, by somebody more powerful than you, by the mob that is screaming the loudest. It was given to you by the one who made you and designed you. And these rights cannot be taken away from you because they are a part of who we are. It is in our design. That phrase changed the world. And it changed human experience within systems of government. And you and I are beneficiaries of something that we had no hand in. Now, it's believed that Thomas Jefferson wrote these words. There was a committee about five people. John Adams was a part of that committee. But there was about a committee of five people. Now, lots of scholars believe that Thomas Jefferson, if we would use terminology of our day, he would not be an evangelical Christian. It's just through his writings, through the things that he said, he would not be an evangelical Christian. The fact that Thomas Jefferson arrived at this truth doesn't change this from being true. The fact that a flawed individual like him could land on something that is true does not change the reality of that truth. There are lots of flawed people. I'm a flawed person trying to teach my children to make sense of the world. And if they said, well, Dad, you're not perfect, I'm not going to listen to you, then we might as well not listen to anybody. You don't have to be perfect to be good. You don't have to be perfect to be able to land on some truth. And this line was what this country has wrestled with most of our existence. Lots of countries don't even entertain this line. They just said, we're up here, you're down there, and we're going to keep it that way. We have wrestled with this statement throughout our entire history, wrestling with it so much so that we were willing to kill brothers and fathers and uncles over this. Are all men created equal? Yes, they are. You cannot enslave someone else because they have just as much value and worth as you do. And many countries have had a civil war. There isn't a country that has gone to battle and fought each other and killed brothers and uncles and fathers and sons over slavery. We said this line is true. It is in our design. This is a truth about reality and civilization. If we could live this out, we will experience something that is different than most of the world has experienced in their entire lives. And on July 4th, 1776, when we recognize our independence, we said, that's true. We want to build our civilization off of this. The lost truth of our civilization, of the American experience, we have worked. Now, when I say we, I'm not talking about you. Our culture has worked really, really hard to remove any last vestiges of God. That mythical creature that we call God, the God of the Hebrew Scriptures, the God of the New Testament that sent his son, Jesus Christ, the God that who existed in the person of Christ, we have worked really hard to get him out of everything. And yet our whole system is based on a belief that God is real. Our whole system is based on a belief that there are certain truths about civilization, about the world, about reality, that if we can put them into an entire system, we will experience human flourishing that has not been experienced all over the world. That is what our founders believed. And many of them died trying to make this happen. And many others died to try and live this out. In order to create a more perfect union. Because we know we are far from perfect. We are a bunch of flawed people. But if we can just have a system of values and shared beliefs and organize ourselves around them, maybe we can create something different. Let's call it an experiment. We'll call it the American experiment. The lost truth of our current situation is we have so devalued and removed God from even our vocabulary that to even just have something as benign as the Ten Commandments posted, plastered on a building, we've got to take it down. Like it's a bad thing to say, don't kill each other, don't lie to each other, don't commit adultery. Like it's a bad thing to say all that, but that needs to be removed. We're losing a truth about civilization. Much of what we see, much of our statuary is built upon a lot of these ideas derived from the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian virtues descending from Jesus himself. You know, it does matter to me because I'm a pastor, and I'd love to see Thomas Jefferson sitting in my pew and worshiping with me on a Sunday. It doesn't change one bit for me the fact that Thomas Jefferson was a flawed sinner in need of redemption and grace, that he was able to pen these words and build a system off of it. I think these are amazing words that no other system of government has based their entire existence off of, so much so that we are willing to kill each other to live this creed out. I think it's a truth that we need to recover. There's dust all over it, and we need to do some rehabbing in our own lives and discover some truths about our civilization. Here are three key truths that I think is discernible through the scriptures. I think through the founding of our country, derived truth about civilization as a result of a Judeo-Christian worldview, regardless of whether or not they lived it out perfectly, regardless of whether or not they had a lot of skeletons in the closet, it doesn't change the truth about what it means for civilization. We all have a lot of sins we need to ask forgiveness for. Thank God he doesn't hold it against us. And toppling statues and burning buildings will not change reality. It will not change the truth about anything. It will only cause us to further get away from how civilizations flourish. Without these three things, I think, derived out of Scripture, our civilization will implode. I was trying to figure out, how do I give you an uplifting message for our July 5th Sunday? And I was trying so hard to do it, it's just not where I'm at right now. And this is my way. I was talking to Tim earlier, and I said, I feel so helpless. I turn on the television, I listen to all this stuff, and I feel like, what in the world can I do? And so I just said, I can at least speak out for what I think is true about the current world that I live in. You know, I'm not a Nepalese. I love Nepalese. I love Liberians. I've gone there. I visited there. I love being there with them, but that's not me. My identity comes through where I grew up. And so it matters to me what my daughter's going to experience when she's 38 years old. What does the world look like that I'm giving to her? We ought to be asking ourselves that question. What's the world going to look like when I give it, when I pass it off? The generation is gone that has passed it on to us. It's our turn now. There's very few that are 103 that saw 103 Independence Days. Jess's grandmother was one of the people that built the world that you and I live in. She, among many others. And now we have to rediscover something that is true about our civilization. We have to realize together that you can know the truth. Knowing what is true is a big part about understanding and making sense of the world, because truth is about objective reality. Truth is telling you and me what is real. So we call them natural laws. It is self-evident that when I take a step off of this platform, I'm going to go right down there. If I climbed up to the top of the church and I took a step off the top of the church building, it is self-evident that gravity exists. It's a natural law. That's what we call it, natural law. It is self-evident that it exists. It doesn't matter what I believe about it. It's not going to change it. I don't even need to sit through lots of boring physics classes and all kinds of science classes to tell me that it's real. And we've got lots of complicated theories to explain to us how we arrive at the fact that gravity is real. All I got to do is take a step off this platform, and I know it's real. That's what truth is. It's describing for us what is really real. I can objectively look out and see, hey, this is true. I can take eyewitness accounts and look at history, and I can put it all together, and I can say this actually happened. It is true that this has taken place, name the event, whatever. Now, that truth is something as opposed to lies or falsehood. In 2016, the most searched word in Merriam-Webster's online dictionary was post-truth. And it was basically said that, how do you live in a post-truth culture? What does that mean? It means that my feelings and my own belief disregard objective reality, and that creates my own personal truth. So it's not what you objectively observe or what is actually true. When six eyewitnesses tell you something, it's how you feel about that thing, and it's what you believe. And so public opinion is now shaped on how you feel and your own personal belief, not based on what is true. In fact, there's many people that don't think you can actually know truth. There is no truth, so you have to create your own. My truth, and you name it, because that's true for me, maybe it's not for you, but you can't know truth. There is no objective truth. That it doesn't matter what time or place you're in, what culture you're in, what language you speak, what ethnicity you are, there's no overarching story. There's no overarching truth. We have worked really hard in our civilization to say that that is our reality. And as hard as we work at reality, it could care less whether or not it offends you. It could care less whether or not you agree with it. That is what is true about reality. That is what we have completely disregarded. It is more comfortable to believe a lie than the truth. The other situation that we have found ourselves in, the lost truth of our civilization, is we used to say there is something that is morally good. There is an absolute moral standard by which we're going to live by. That's kind of why we got the Ten Commandments plastered all over the halls of justice, because we want to say we can recognize what is good and what is evil. And as a culture, we used to be able to say that. This is good and this is evil. And now if I try and do that, you can't call that evil. That's offensive. That's wrong. You're just superimposing your own belief system upon theirs. You can no longer say that that is good. It is wrong to lie. Well, maybe it is for you, but it's important that I can keep doing that. And this lie is more comfortable than the truth, and we're going to believe it. And look, all these people here, they believe the same thing as I do. And I know you're saying this is evil, but can this whole crowd, this whole mob of people be wrong? Well, if you have an absolute moral standard, you'd say, yeah, you can be. We've lost that. We've lost the ability to look out at a world and say, that is evil, that is good. When you can't look out at our landscape and see cities burning, people being brutalized, some horrible YouTube videos, some horrible Facebook Live videos of people being beaten, and you can't look at that and say that that's evil? Oh, well, they have insurance. It's not, who cares? That's what we've come to. We can't look at that and say that's wrong. Because if you can't look at that and say evil, here's the other thing that goes. You're not going to know what the right thing to do is. And people will just stop doing the right thing. We devolve into something that's called tribalism. We've had tribalism in our world since the beginning, the 12 tribes of Israel that became one unified people. Tim and I were talking earlier. He met a guy that was a truck driver here in the United States. He's been here for 10 years. He's from Liberia. He's like, oh, you know, my pastor's been to Liberia. We've got churches in Liberia. And he starts to tell Tim about the civil war that he experienced, tribes fighting each other, so one can have power over the other one. When I was there and listening to the guys in our church, the ladies in our church, describe for me what they experienced as a result of one tribe fighting the other tribe, because we believe this is right, and we believe it so much, we're just going to kill you because you don't believe it with us. And going down the line saying, giving them a number, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 2's over here, 1's over here, and we'll kill the 2's. That only happened in the 90s is when the Civil War took place in Liberia, the 1990s. We lose our understanding of what is right and the right thing to do. How we choose to live, how we choose to use our freedom. One thing the United States of America was able to do better than any other country in civilization was be able to hold these two things in tension or in balance, however you want to choose it, between order and freedom. One end of the spectrum is tyranny. You know how we keep order? I tell you you're free, and if you disagree with me and I don't believe what I believe, we call them dictators and tyrants. The other end is chaos, is anarchy. Whoever decides the rules makes the rules, whatever is right, and they believe is right, they do that. You can look back at history. We call that the French Revolution, where the guys who started the revolution, by the end of it, got their heads chopped off by the guillotine. There's the two ends of the spectrum, and we said, freedom is what we ought to do. Not whatever I want to do, but what is the right thing to do? What is the good thing to do? What is true about our civilization and about reality? Unless we discover these things, which our foundation was built upon, these 244 years of what we call the American experiment, our civilization will implode. There are signs of it now when you turn your television on and you see our cities burning. And when you have leaders that can't stand up in front of the camera and say what is right and what is good and what is true. There are leaders leading our country that ought to be ashamed of themselves. They ought to be ashamed of themselves for what they are saying. What are we as a people to do? I have been wrestling with this for weeks. It's affected my attitude. It's affected my sleep. Trying to figure out how do I communicate this in a way that gets across to people and what we are seeing, how we make sense of the world and realize that if we don't get it together, the civilization that I'm going to pass on to my kids is going to be a pretty scary one. And that's okay if you think, Ted, you're being overdramatic about all this. This has happened in the past, and that's okay. You can think that. I think 2020 will be a year in which we look back on in history as a moment where we decide, are we going to stand up for what is right and true and good? And as a follower of Jesus, I'm not just going to lay down and say, what's good for you is good for you. Just you stay in your corner, and I'll stay in mine corner. Because as we've seen throughout history, it's not too long before they start coming for you. We need to draw the line and say, here's the line, here and no further. I am convicted to say that there are people running our country that have completely disregarded any of these things. And if you say that you want to lead and bring truth and justice for all, then you've got to at least comply with these lost truths of civilization. And I, as a follower of Jesus, am not just going to go along with the mob. And I'm broken over what I see in our country. And I'm broken over the fact that we can't even come to the place where we can look at something and say that is wrong, that is evil, that is not consistent with life and the really real. We are believing a pack of lies. Good people, not perfect people, good people have to be willing to take a stand and say, I can define what is right and true and good. I can know the truth. I can look at something and say that is evil and it ought not to be done. We shouldn't do that to people. And I can do the right thing. I think that's where we're at. That's where I'm at. Like I said, I don't think, and I don't want you to walk away from here and assume that you have to agree with everything I've said. I think Josiah's Day is a picture. It's a story that informs our story. That unless we dust off these lost truths of our civilization, we won't be able to experience what we've been experiencing for 244 years. No, it hasn't been perfect, but it's been pretty good. And you can go all over the world and find that same refrain. And it's been pretty good because we were willing to say these things that are derived from knowing who God is and making sense of the world through the scriptures. And if anybody else ought to stand up for that, it ought to be us as Christians to stand up for these things. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the American story. As flawed and messed up and broken as it is, I'm thankful for the people that believe these things about reality, believe these things about civilization, and put them into an entire system. And we've inherited them, Lord. We've been benefactors of them. And unfortunately, we've kind of forgotten about them. God, I do pray for healing for this broken land. Lord, I pray that you would help us as followers of Jesus to be able to live out the truth, bear witness to the fact that you have done something in this world to make it right again. We, of anyone, ought to be the biggest evangelists of identifying truth and goodness and doing what is right, because that is pointing people directly to the person of Jesus Christ. God, may we stand on these foundational truths for another 244 years. God, may we be able to stand up for what is right and true and good. May we give to our children and to their children a place to live that allows human flourishing and that tells a great story about bringing people into freedom and liberty to experience life maybe as they've never experienced before. God, give us the strength of our convictions to stand firm on your truth. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.